Ho, 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 hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug, the Christmas movie podcast that is so close to having the perfect Christmas. All I need now is an official Red Ryder carbine action 200-shot range model air rifle with a compass in the stock and this thing that tells time. And then Christmas will be perfect. I'm your host, Helen O'Hara. Hello. And joining me today is one of the most prolific podcasters, I think, that is around right now. He's the host of 90 Minutes or Less. He's the host of the Picture House podcast. And particularly relevant to right now, he is the host of The Holiday Season, the incredibly in-depth dive to Nancy Meyers' holiday classic. He is, of course, Sam Clements. Hello, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm looking for corny in my life. What can I say? You know, it's that time of year where I'm feeling all festive. And yeah, we really get to deep dive into Nancy Meyers' classic rom-com, The Holiday. But I'm good. I'm excited. It's the end of the year and it's the best time of the year. Christmas. All these great Christmas films. Oh my God.
All these great Christmas films. Exactly. And it's, and yeah, this is an interesting pair that we're going to be talking about today. So we are going to be talking about A Christmas Story, which I have touched on a little bit before in this podcast. Now, this is a film that is massive historically in the US and pretty much unknown here in the UK. It's a 1983 film from director Bob Clark, one of those guys who had a fascinating career, because on one hand, he made Black Christmas and Porky's, and then he made this incredibly sweet, somewhat sincere Christmas film, A Christmas Story. So it's a broad spectrum career that he had in regards to Christmas just on his own. But A Christmas Story has this year had a sequel, which is called A Christmas Story Christmas, which is quite hard to keep in your head, quite frankly. And this one is stars once again. So the child star of the original, Peter Billingsley, has returned as Ralphie, who was the kid in the original movie. And he's now grown up. And in the wake of his father's death, Old Man Parker, he is trying to provide his children with the same kind of great Christmas that he remembers from his own childhood. Now, of course, as we know, having recently seen or rewatched, in our case, I think, A Christmas Story, his own childhood wasn't always, you know, a bed of roses, but he has very fond memories of it. So yeah, first of all, Sam, what did you think of A Christmas Story Christmas?
A Christmas Story Christmas, which is a fun thing to say. I guess it's funny, we're in that era of legacy sequels. And like, I don't know if anyone needed a sequel to A Christmas Story, if people were crying out for that, especially in the UK, where, as you said before, like the awareness is super low. But this is a really famous film in the US, so popular on television in America. And like, I guess so the conceit of the first one is that it's sort of, it was made in the 80s, but it's reflecting on Christmas in the 40s. And yeah, Now in this sequel, it's Christmas in the 70s, but obviously yes, Made in 2022. So the first one, I think, is totally alien to me, where like I really have no reference for what Christmas in the 40s in America may have been like. I think with this sequel, I think the 70s is something we have seen on screen a bit more. So like I sort of was a bit more invested in that. And I went in with quite low expectations, so it was pleasantly surprised. I was a bit more drawn in. And I think also the modern filmmaking has worked really well. Like, I think they've done a really good job of making an audience who maybe do not know A Christmas Story so well care about the characters in this. And I thought it was it sort of caught me off guard. I was really affected by this film. I had a little tear as I was watching it in one particular scene. And yeah, it delivers. And there's one joke in particular which made me belly laugh so loud. I had to sort of pause the film and rewind it and watch it again.
that's a good sign, I think, in a film like this, because the original film, for those who haven't seen it, it is literally a sort of slice of life kind of a thing. It's a series of very loosely connected vignettes, really, isn't it? I mean, so it's based on the writings of Gene Shepherd, who was a sort of famous kind of American kind of, I guess, raconteur. He was a storyteller. He did a lot of radio reading and things like that. He's actually the narrator of the original A Christmas Story, as well as writing the script for it. And it was kind of semi-autobiographical, I think. But he gave a little lilt of irony and a remove, I think, because that was part of his sense of humor. But also he remembered and he portrayed so clearly that feeling of being a kid and being absolutely desperate for this one thing that you have to have that your Christmas entirely depends upon. And that's the sort of, if there's one through line to the original Christmas story, isn't it? It's will Ralphie get this BB gun for Christmas? And what every single person, every adult in his life tells him about this BB gun for Christmas.
Absolutely.
Your eye out.
I think the big thing is the sort of voiceover in both of the films, delivered in both cases by Ralphie, young and now a bit older. But it's sort of like this sort of like weird, like, especially in the first one, you know, like sort of reflecting on his sort of childhood and, like, you know, quite grown up words for a child sort of there. But it's really interesting, that sort of like inner monologue, and it sort of just adds an extra layer to the scenes and helps with gags as well, you know, like reacting to stuff we see on screen through voiceover. So we're very much sort of in the head of a character reflecting on this sort of particular Christmas.
Yes. And sometimes giving things a bit of an epic spin, isn't he? When it's the most minor thing in the world.
Oh yeah. Like, there's a lot of, you know, like very trivial things, but the humor is so heightened by, you know, that is the one thing you should never ask a child, and all of this sort of business, which really works. It's quite, I don't know if it's like just because it's Bob Clark and it's the 80s and you know, he's sort of a bit out there as a filmmaker, he's quite loose with the form. You know, there's lots of like transitions and like crash zooms and wipes and stuff, and things are often played out like a sketch. Like, this is a sketch. I'm putting up the tree and it'll be 5 minutes long and blah, blah, blah. But it sort of works. It keeps it fresh. I didn't find the first one super funny, really. I always thought it was a bit weird, and it was kind of like a gross Christmas film. Like, there's lots of scenes of like children are eating with their mouths open, and, you know, it's a bit like rough around the edges. And I don't know if that's me or if it's the film, but it didn't really sort of translate. But in the sequel, I think they do all of that stuff still, but do it so much better. And I didn't find the new one like kind of super gross.
Good, I think. Yes, yeah, I think it's a strange. It's a strange and kind of almost unique sort of tone that this one has, especially among Christmas films, which tend to the very sincere or the very broad. It does tread this particular road. And I think you're right, the new one does manage to recapture some of that. So it does still take some of, I think, Gene Shepherd's words and certainly a lot of his tone. He's sadly no longer with us. And it does, you know, it's co-written, I think, and still stars Peter Billingsley, who was, of course, the child Ralphie in the first one. And he's clearly lived with this his whole life, like for what, nearly 40 years now. He's had people, I'm sure, coming up to him and wanting to talk about A Christmas Story all year round. He still kind of looks like little Ralphie. Like, he has not, you know, the hair is a bit darker. He's obviously gotten a bit taller, but he still looks like Ralphie. And so it feels like he is someone who has kind of marinated himself in this and who has brought the ability to find a Christmas story-y story for this new sequel. So he's a struggling writer. His father dies, and his mother, who's the main recast person in this, all of his friends are played by the original actors, which I thought was an incredibly charming touch. But his mum was originally played by Melinda Dillon, of course, of Close Encounters fame, and she sadly has retired. So Julie Haggerty of Airplane fame has stepped in as his mum this time. But otherwise, you know, it really does feel almost like a family affair. It feels like getting the gang back together just to kind of kid around a little bit.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Like, a lot of the actors, and, you know, often child actors don't carry on to grow up to be actors. There are famous exceptions to that, but a lot of the actors from the original sort of 1983 film, they haven't done a bunch. You know, some of them carried on doing some child acting and then sort of stopped, or, you know, maybe they just sort of left the profession entirely. But like, pretty much all of them featured children have come back as grown-ups, and it's really nice to see, especially like I watched these two quite close together, so that was sort of nice. But the film, if you just watched the new film, they do sort of have a little flashback for most people, I think, which shows them in the original movie. And
yes,
I don't think it's like sort of super plot essential to have seen the original. I think it will work if you just wanted to put this new one on its own.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it kind of it is all there, and there are some, you know, very deep cuts. If you are a fan of the original movie, there are little kind of throwaway lines and sort of lifting jokes and lifting references from the original. But yeah, you don't have to have seen it. This is an entirely new story, essentially about a, you know, a man who's struggling a bit in his career takes his family home for Christmas. And but what I loved about the running joke in this is he's determined that his family has the perfect Christmas and that everything goes well. And all three of his family end up injured. So there's broken limbs. There's a sort of an eye almost put out, which I assume is a nod to the original as well. It, you know, there's definitely a sort of dramatic irony, let's say, in the attempt to make a perfect Christmas.
It's quite funny. Yeah, like, you know, spoiler alert, but towards the end, Christmas does happen and the family are all around the dinner table in like various casts and eye patches and stuff. And Ralphie's absolutely, you know, fine, albeit having been on an emotional journey.
Yeah, very much. And I think what's nice about both films, actually, and what sometimes gets overlooked for its dramatic potential, and I genuinely think there should be more Christmas films about this particular thing, the pressure that so many people feel to make Christmas perfect, to make Christmas special. And, you know, if you are busy, as many of us are, especially this time of year, if you are, you know, not well off, as many of us aren't at the moment, if you are just struggling in any way with grief, with loss, with illness, with whatever, that can be a major, major challenge. And almost no Christmas films really, truly get to grips with that. I mean, yes, there'll be, you know, lip service to, oh, you know, your mum died. It's always the mum. Your mum died. Oh, no. But there won't be a sort of, how are we going to make Christmas happen this year? I mean, you could make a case for National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, maybe. But generally speaking, I feel like this whole area of dramatic possibility is sort of overlooked.
I agree. I was sort of thinking about this as you're talking, and the only thing that comes to mind is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, where it's the dad, especially, who's very keen to drive in an excessive way that sort of perfect Christmas, quote unquote. And it is quite a fun sort of thing because, like, you know, usually the person is sort of a little bit inept, out of their depth, but they have this perfect ideal, which they can't quite, you know, realize. And they find the true meaning of Christmas along the way. Classic story arc. What I like about this film is, like, you're right, they talk about the hardships. They very clearly, so this film, Ralphie has taken a year out of work because he wants to become a writer, and they've agreed he's got a year to become a published author, otherwise he'll go back, you know, back to his day job, as it were. So, like, they're already, like, they set up the stakes. The family are living on a particular budget, and they've worked up they can afford to do that for 1 year only. And they have a Christmas fund, and they have a really great Christmas shopping scene in this film as well, which I really enjoyed. But alas, doesn't all go to plan, and they lose the gifts. And, like, you see the hardship. They've literally talked to us about how limited money is, and how they've somehow managed to buy all the things they need to buy, and then they're not there anymore. So, like, you're sort of, like, you know, you're along for the ride there. And I think they handle this in, like, a really nice, it's still comedic, but you know what's at stake the whole time. So I think you're invested dramatically.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there has to be a little bit of drama here, you know, and even in the first film, I think with Ralphie's quest to get his ridiculous BB gun, I feel like you could invest in that because there's always something that one of us wanted. You know, it was maybe the, you know, the top of the line My Little Pony toy that you kind of knew your parents didn't have room for or money for, but you really kind of wanted, but you maybe talked yourself down to the smaller stable. I don't know. I'm sure that's your experience too, Sam. But but the result, you know, there are these things that obsess you as a kid. And also what I loved in the original as well, and what you see a little bit of here, although not too much, was Ralphie's daydreaming. So, you know, when he writes an essay for his teacher about how much he wants this gun for Christmas, and he just has visions of basically, you know, this is going to change everybody's life. Like, she is going to love this so much. This is the best thing he or anyone has ever written. It's pretty much up there with Shakespeare. And he turns it in, and, well, things don't go according to plan. I love that there is a little bit of a callback to that in this one, that he imagines himself basically winning a prize for his 2,000-page science fiction novel that he has labored over with, wasn't it, Isaac Asimov, Frank Herbert, and Anne McCaffrey.
Yes.
just standing there cheering him on because they thought they all voted for him as well, you know, as his fellow nominees. It is kind of glorious because we do all have these little daydreams, don't we? You know, the actor who dreams about winning an Oscar, the person who has never acted who daydreams about winning an Oscar. it's all very relatable.
I think, yeah, it sort of, it carries on that sort of like using the voiceover in like Ralphie's inner monologue as a key sort of storytelling device. So yeah, we often hear the voiceover. We sometimes go into his head and sort of see what he's imagining. But I did really love that writing scene. And like, it's just funny to have him in a lineup with like Frank Herbert and other like big 70s names in sci-fi. And I can't remember what his book's called. It's like Neptune Rising or something like that.
It's Neptune something, because it definitely wasn't Jupiter as something, wasn't it? He corrects the publisher on that.
And even that title sort of taps into that like 70s sort of sci-fi vibe. Like that was just like a little tiny thing, but like it feels authentic. Like you can tell he's reading Herbert, etc., and he wants to do his own thing.
And he just hasn't learned how to edit at all, you know, even slightly.
Is it a 2,000 page manuscript or something he's handing in? And he's writing the sequel already, and like he's getting way too ahead of himself. You know, he's so ambitious, this guy, but eager to please, but he's sort of failing at the dad stuff. I also think actually in that first scene where they talk about the budget, he's so wrapped up in his writing, he's forgot to go grocery shopping, and he sort of tries to convince the kids to have orange juice on their cornflakes or, you know, whatever it is there. And that's like another sort of like thing I think carries over from the first film, like just kind of like gross food pairings.
Yes, very, very much so. And as you say, gross eating scenes sometimes as well. So in this one, because his father has recently died, basically everyone in town has given his mother a casserole. And you know, I hear casserole, I think, oh, that sounds delicious. None of these look or sound edible. You know, they all sound absolutely grotesque. So you've still got a little bit of that kind of food horror, I suppose, from the first film.
One of them is a mayonnaise and ketchup casserole.
Oof. We may need to take a moment while I just compose myself.
Hello, I'm Kate Lever, host of Who's a Good Dog? The podcast for anyone who's ever loved a dog. We're one of the other podcasts in the Stripped Media family. Each episode, I ask a brilliant person to introduce me to their dog and tell me how having a dog has changed their life. Listen to Who's a Good Dog wherever you get your podcasts.
When he sort of goes back to the old town, I just sort of love how the community is still around him as well. Like, and I think that's the thing for Christmas films. Like, yeah, I guess Wonderful Life, It's a Wonderful Life is the most famous sort of one, but like everybody knows everybody's name, and he goes into the bar and his old school friend who we see in the first film is now the bar owner and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I think they do such a good job of weaving that sort of like legacy suite sequel sort of like trope in, but without it feeling too cumbersome. And I don't know, maybe it gets a bit of a more generous pass because it's a Christmas film, and you know, those are sort of usually a bit more of like a novelty anyway. But I think it's done really well, like with some actual sort of thought and craft there. And yeah, I don't know, I found the whole thing sort of quite a winning experience.
I find the same. And I'll be honest, now you said at the start you weren't sure that this story ever needed a sequel. The funny thing is, it's part of a bit of a cinematic franchise. It's a bit of a Parker cinematic universe, if you will. So before A Christmas Story came out, there had already been two stories based on these tales by Gene Shepherd. So The Phantom of the Open Hearth in 1976, which was made for TV, and then The Great American Fourth of July and Other Disasters, which were sort of mixed reaction and then positive reaction, respectively. And that second one is probably why A Christmas Story got made the following year. But they did then keep trying to recapture that lightning in a bottle, especially as the time went on and it became a sort of established Christmas favorite for the US. So in 1985, there was The Star-Crossed Romance of Josephine Kosnowski. And in 1988, Ollie Hopnoodle's Haven of Bliss, which has got to go down as one of the all-time great titles of anything.
Wow.
yeah, those two got okay positive reactions. They were both made for TV. The real problems came later. So something that was released as My Summer Story got a little bit of an okay reaction back in 1994, but A Christmas Story 2 actually came out in 2012 and was famously a disaster. It was absolutely, I think, hated by most people who saw it. And, you know, there were good people involved in making it. It's not that they didn't have any decent cast. They had people like Daniel Stern involved as the old man. So, you know, he's good with a Christmas movie. He we've seen that in Home Alone. But it really seemed to anger the fans. So I feel like this one had it all to play for, really, going in and trying to convince anybody that we still needed to see anything of this world and Ralphie and the Parkers.
That's wild. I didn't realize that there were so many sort of Christmas Story or Ralphie Parker kind of spin-offs. That's amazing. I need to check out at least a trailer for Christmas Story 2 after this to sort of indulge. But Peter Billingsley sort of had a similar thing where he is kind of like a lucky mascot to a lot of filmmakers making Christmas films. I think he sort of pops up in things like Elf and other sort of films like that. And he's actually like produced quite a lot of Christmas films as well. So like he's kind of, I don't know, like I guess Christmas is, whether it's his thing by choice or just where the industry has shoehorned him. But he produced Christmas with the Campbells, and I think he's produced a couple of other Christmases. Oh, it was involved with Four Christmases, the Vince Vaughn Christmas movie. So it's just kind of interesting that he sort of kept a toe in there, but he's also just had like very small acting roles. He hasn't had a major acting career, I don't think, but he has popped up in stuff. He's in Four Christmases, he's in Elf, you know, and I just imagine like Jon Favreau being a fan of Christmas Story and asking him to come and, you know, sort of play an elf or something for one scene.
I think that was exactly it. Isn't he the one who's worried about keeping up with production?
Yes, I think he wears an elf, you know, with like blonde hair and glasses, like giving him a bit of a Ralphie Parker kind of look there. But that's kind of amazing. Like, so yeah, I think he's like a bit of a cottage industry on championing Christmas and doing Ralphie-like characters. But great performance from him as well.
I feel like that's good. Ralphie would want that, wouldn't it? I mean, if Ralphie had the option of, for example, being a producer on an Iron Man film, which Peter Billingsley has done, I feel like Ralphie would not hesitate.
You just do it. I wonder if that was like after his work on Elf, if Favreau's like, yeah, come on, we're doing Iron Man next. Ralphie.
Actually, yeah, he worked with Favreau quite a bit. He was also on Zathura.
Oh, amazing. Wow.
So, you know, that would make sense. But yeah, it's good, I think, to see former child actor living the life, you know, still involved in the industry, still clearly, I think, having a good time in it. And even then, after all this time, being able to revisit, if you like, his greatest hit as an actor and bring something fresh to it.
And like being also just like being good, like it's not guaranteed that if you're a good child actor that you'll be a good adult actor. But I think he's carrying the film in here, and he's got such a, he's like, he's got a good look. He can do the slapstick stuff really well. He can deliver the voiceover because it was Gene Shepherd, I think, did the voiceover in the original, like the actual author. So he sort of steps into the Gene Shepherd role of delivering the sort of inner monologue. And you know, he can do that sort of, you know, like inner monologue line reading so well. I just found his voice really reassuring, like really like deep and husky, you know, but he can still be a goofball.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. No, I just think I didn't know what to expect from this. And look, it is very gentle. And I think if anything, it probably has less of a through line at times than the original film did. And it barely had a through line. Very much, as I say, a series of scenes and here are some things that happened. And this sometimes feels even looser, even though there is, yes, the countdown to Christmas and, oh, can we make it perfect for the kids? But it's not like it's a sort of, you know, a checklist that they're going through and ticking off successfully. And, you know, it doesn't have a kind of countdown element to it. So it's a sort of a very kind of easygoing, laid back affair. And you do have to kind of tune into that. You know, if you're used to, you know, a slightly livelier kind of film, I think it does take a minute to almost get your brain to slow down to these films' pace.
Yes. Yeah. It does have that sort of like old school filmmaking technique about it. And the joy of a Christmas film, I think, is something that you could put on the telly over the holidays where you can, you know, happily do a couple of films on an afternoon. And this would be such a nice afternoon watch, you know, and yeah, it just sort of like welcomes you in. Like I rewatched the first one for the podcast and I was like, oh, I don't really know if I will need a sequel to this. It sort of turned me off. I think I liked the first one less after my rewatch, but then this one drew me back in. So yeah, there's testament to the filmmaking here, and I guess we should, you know, sort of shout out the director as well, who's also got previous Christmas film form, Clay Catus, who did the Sexy Santa film a couple of years ago, Christmas Chronicles.
Which Sexy Santa film? Because now there's quite a few.
So the Christmas Chronicles with yes. Kurt Russell. I think that was Clay Catus's previous credit. Before then, had worked on things like the Angry Birds movie. So he went from Sexy Santa to a not very sexy Santa in A Christmas Story, because there is a Santa, and we learn he is the real Santa according to the children's test in the sequel.
Yeah, that was a very charming scene. I think both films actually have a great visiting Santa scene. By the way, if anybody reads Humans of New York on Instagram, there's also been a great department store Santa featured there. But I think the Santa scenes in these two films are pretty much unimprovable. So in this one, Ralphie's daughter basically quizzing Santa to make sure he's the right one, and in the previous film, Ralphie going to see Santa and then being so paralyzed by his deep and abiding wish for this air rifle that he basically freezes up and can't even speak. I mean, they're just wonderful, and I think it's that level of kind of specificity that really makes these films seem. I mean, what did you think of the balance of kind of slapstick and that kind of reference humor in this film?
I didn't. So I thought the slapstick was done really well. And there's a couple of like good wins in that respect. There's a snowball fight scene after a few drinks in the department store, normal, where Ralphie accidentally hits his very small daughter with a snowball and has to take her to hospital. And the timing, the setup, like that was a perfect, that 60 second scene of like them doing all of that stuff is perfect. Like, it's perfect slapstick, and it made me laugh. That's the scene that made me laugh so hard I had to stop the film and go back and rewatch it. And I my wife was in another room, and I was like, you just need to watch this one sequence. And she also did a big like, that is perfect. And there's a few examples of that, you know, where like the comedy is just really well set up. It's not like a laugh out loud film throughout for its whole like 100 minute runtime, but there's enough in there to sort of keep a smile on your face. I think the references at the end of the film in the credits, there are like photos side by side, which is maybe a nice touch, but I think that depends on your reverence for the first film, and maybe mileage could vary on that. I guess it helped highlight, even though I'd only just watched the first one, it sort of helped highlight some links which I didn't quite notice on my watch. I think that's fine. It's like you can take or leave the references for me, but it was. I just thought the nicest touch was getting the original cast back in all of the adult roles in the town.
Like, who does that? Do you know what I mean? I was genuinely astonished. And you know, like you say, some of them have had more of an acting role than others. Zach Ward, who plays the former bully Scott Farkas, he's in stuff. You see his face and you're like, oh yeah, I've seen, you're in stuff, I know you. But I think R.D. Robb as Schwartz, you know, maybe a bit less so. And was it Yano Anaya as Grover again? I haven't seen very much, but I just thought it was really nice that they made the effort, you know, and that it did feel like a bit of a class reunion. I quite enjoyed also the sledding scene where a bunch of adults attempt to go down a hill, and you realise why we leave that to children most of the time, because it tends to end very badly.
Yeah, drunk adults from the pub trying to do sledding. That was a really good sequence. I really liked that. It's like really well observed, and there's like plenty of gags. Also, I think it's an 80s film thing. I think films these days are a bit more sort of polished, but like when people fall over, it feels like they do get hurt, you know, and it's like in Home Alone, for example, like, you know, you feel the pain that the guys breaking in are going through, and I think it's the same in this film and in the original. Like, you sort of feel, you know, how messy it can be just being a human, you know, being bullied or falling over or doing whatever you do there. I sort of like that, you know. It felt a bit lived in.
It did. And if you're one of the people who fell over the last few days here in the UK, it's been snowing and icy, sympathies to you, but at least you are upholding a fine old tradition, I guess, of, well, frankly, pratfalls on ice, as shown in both these movies. I also love the fact, and I feel like this might not fly if they did another sequel in 30 years, is in almost every scene, the adults seem to be drinking their way through Christmas. And again, I just don't think you see that a lot in modern Christmas movies.
No, it really does go for a lot of the, I guess, the sort of vices of being a grown up there. But there's so much, there's quite a few sort of like, you know, big drinking scenes, which is, you know, maybe true of the Christmas season. And some of them are like, you know, quite stereotypical, like the bar they go to is a bit of a dive bar and it's all men pretty much. Mm-hmm. And they even do the thing the Simpsons do in most tavern where, you know, someone phones up and it's a family member looking for a person and they say the guy's name and everybody in the bar is quiet. You know, like the stuff, it's kind of like they do it in such a charming way. You don't mind that you've seen it before, or like maybe it's a little bit old fashioned.
Very much so. Yeah. And the fact just the mother and grandmother pretty much have a wine glass in their hand the whole second half of the movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess fair play, whatever you take to get through Christmas, I guess. I'm not saying it's a wonderful example, but it is probably quite true to life.
I really liked, actually, one of the new characters in this is Ralphie's wife, who's a new sort of, I guess, cast member into the Christmas Story franchise. I thought she was perfect. She sort of fits in perfectly with the tone and the acting style of the films. Erin Hayes plays Sandy Parker, who's Ralphie's wife, and like they're really good, like they got really good dynamic together. They feel like a proper team, and yeah. You know, there's a grandparent to look after and there's children to look after, and you know, they're sort of on the same page. There's a scene where Ralphie needs to come up with a plan for Christmas, so he goes to the pub and he writes all of his ideas drunkenly on a napkin, and it's quite a charming scene of him hungover in bed and she's reading them out to him, and like that's such a good, like that says so much about their relationship, and I thought her performance was great. I don't know if I know Erin Hayes, like she's got credits, but
you would have seen her in Bill and Ted Face the Music, I guess. I'm sure you probably saw that. But she's done a lot of American TV, I think, for the most part. So she's out there. She's you know, she's a proper actress. She's got a fair amount going on. But yeah, she's not maybe a household name over here. In the same way that, you know, Peter Billingsley isn't. I also just love seeing Julie Hegarty in anything. I feel like she was so, so great in Airplane. Mm. So anytime she comes up, first of all, I have lovely warm feelings about Airplane that come back. But also she just has that very gentle, kind of reserved, very sweet energy. And then anything she says becomes funnier because of that. You know, she, I think, is a bit of a comedy genius. She was in Marriage Story, wasn't she, a couple of years ago, which was unlikely casting, I thought, but worked perfectly.
Yeah.
And yeah, anytime she turns up, frankly, I think you're in for a good time.
I think, yeah, no, she's got a really good sort of ongoing gag, which is the carolers and her sort of phobia of carolers. And there's a great sort of overreaction scene. A lot of the humor comes from people overreacting to very day-to-day sort of things. But turn all the lights off, you know, duck behind the windows. The carolers are coming. And that scene is sort of like, that's one of her big moments. It's so good. But yeah, she's a what a champion actor, and weirdly, I think we covered one of her previous Christmas films on this podcast last time I was a guest, Noelle.
That's right, yes.
So she's got form in a Christmas movie too.
She has. This is it. It's all coming back to Christmas. Well done. Well done, Julie. And look, I mean, and I also think, by the way, she's a good fit for sort of Melinda Dillon's energy in the first film. You know, she was also very sweet, very kind, apart from when she was washing Ralphie's mouth out with soap, and slightly worried, you know, had that slightly anxious air. And I think Julie Hegarty matches that very well. Melinda Dillon, of course, sadly now retired, and the old man himself, Mr. Parker, who was played by Darren McGavin, he sadly left us a few years ago. So it was nice that the film becomes a bit of a tribute to him and becomes a little bit of a, you know, the character is still so present in everyone's memories. So that's a thumbs up on A Christmas Story Christmas then.
Yeah, it's like the legacy sequel we didn't know we needed or deserved. And they really knocked it out of the park. Like, I think it's a really nice, like, filmmaking team. So good as well to see, like, Peter Billingsley, like, has embraced his childhood role. And a lot of child actors, like, they don't want to talk about that one, you know, that thing they did now. But, you know, he's made a success of this. You know, he's so involved in this film and delivers such a nice performance. But yeah, it's just a great Christmas film. And like, I don't know if it might be heresy, but I think I just prefer this new one to the original.
Wow. Well, look, if the axe wielding, flame wielding hordes want to come after you, Sam, for that opinion, where can they find you online? Where should they look you up? Wait, that sounded wrong.
Send all hate mail and or, you know, nice messages to me on Twitter at Sam_Clements. And you can find our podcasts wherever you're listening to this, the 90 Minutes or Less Film Fest and the Holiday Season and the Love of Cinema, the podcast we do for Picture House Cinemas. My voice is on the internet a fair bit. But it's been really nice to actually talk about this film, which I don't think has had a proper rollout in the UK at least, and it is sort of hiding on streaming services, but it's well worth your time this holiday season if you're looking for, you know, for something pleasant to watch in the run-up to Christmas. And you know, you'll find it charming. It's a good time. You will laugh out loud at least a couple of times.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, for those who are looking for it, on Now TV and Sky, as far as I can tell. I haven't managed to find it on all the other streaming services yet, but it may well be there by the time you listen to this. So that was A Christmas Story and A Christmas Story Christmas. Try saying that three times fast. Thank you very much to my guest, Sam Clements, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, folks.
Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Omanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.